Well, it is time for us to wish our listeners who have a birthday today a very happy birthday. We have one listener we're aware of, Dorothy Latimer from Pocahontas. Dorothy, all of us here at IRIS would like to wish you a very happy birthday. And a reminder, if you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service, and if you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now, here's Barb with today's obituaries.
Thank you, Dennis. Tina Louise Logsdon, born on August 19, 1966 in Des Moines, to George and Genevieve Logsdon, has peacefully passed away on April 13th in her home, surrounded by all her loved ones. Tina was preceded in death by her parents, whom she cherished deeply. Tina leaves behind a legacy of love and warmth, survived by her siblings, Nancy Shiner of Baxter, David Logsdon of Bondurant, Kathy Clark of Baxter, and Linda Smith of Baxter. Several nieces and nephews, well, actually many nieces, nephews, and grand-nieces, great-nieces and nephews. She also leaves behind her Cali cat, who is her beloved companion, who brought her comfort and joy. She graduated from Ruby Van Meter School in Des Moines in 1987, where she was a cheerleader. She played on the basketball team, was a bell ringer, and was prom queen. Her warm and welcoming nature extended beyond her school years, starting with her time at Link in Des Moines, where she created lasting friendships. Tina continued to spread joy at Progress Industries in Newton, Iowa, after moving to Baxter in 1993. Music and dancing were not just hobbies for Tina, they were expressions of her vibrant soul. She found solace and joy in every beat, her dancing feet never still. She loved attending dancing competitions with her sister Kathy, and she watched her great niece. The Iowa State Fair held a special place in her heart. It became an annual tradition to visit for her birthday, reveling in the music at the Bill Riley stage and soaring on the sky glider. Tina thought it was so cool that they would stop the sky glider just for her to get on it. She was a horror movie enthusiast. She loved going to craft shows with her sisters and sitting next to the campfire. When she wasn't dancing or going to craft shows, she always had to have a deck of cards in front of her. That was Tina. A simple deck of cards would put a smile on her face. Beyond her interests, Tina's kindness and compassion were her defining traits. Her radiant smile that could brighten the darkest of days. Her hugs were legendary, capable of melting away worries and bringing comfort to all who crossed her path. Her genuine kindness and infectious positivity left an indelible mark on all who knew her. A service to honor and celebrate Tina's life will be held at Pence Reist Funeral Home at 11 a.m. on Saturday, April 20th. The family will greet friends from 10 a.m. until the service time on Saturday. The family requests that you wear bright colors in honor of Tina. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to Progress Industries of Newton, Iowa, or the National Down Syndrome Society in memory of Tina Louise Logsdon. Tina's memory will forever live on in the hearts of those who were touched by her love and bright light. Barbara Klassen, age 85, of Des Moines, passed away peacefully, surrounded by family, on April 13th. A celebration of life will be held at the Sunset Memorial Chapel on Fleur Drive in Des Moines on Friday, April 19th at 11 a.m. with lunch to follow. For full details and obituary, please visit sunsetmemorialchapel.com/post/Barbara-Palladino-Klassen. Lady Christabel Hira Bomsey. In loving memory of our beloved mother, Lady Christabel Europe Ponzi, we are saddened to announce her untimely passing on March 18th. She was surrounded by her family. A funeral will be held on April 20th in West Des Moines, Iowa. Mary Carol Beach, 94, of Adel, passed away on April 5th at Spurgeon Manor Nursing Home in Dallas Center. A visitation for Mary will be held from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. on Saturday, April 20th, at Faith Lutheran Church in Adel, with a service beginning at 11 a.m. Burial will follow at Oakdale Cemetery. Mary was born in Perry Hospital on March 4th, 1930, to Lily Gomez and William Gomez. She attended Adel Grade School and High School, graduated in 1948. Mary attended AIB in Des Moines and worked for Silver Aircraft in Des Moines. And in 1958, she went to Denver, Colorado. She worked for Exxon Corporation for 32 years and was a legal assistant when she retired in 1990. In 1967, Mary married Charlie in Denver, where they worked and lived for 35 years. After retirement, they enjoyed golf and cruising, spending time with family and friends in several states, spent several years in the villages in Florida, and spent winters in Arizona with Debbie, Kaylee, and Rodney. In 2004, Mary and Charlie moved to Adel, where Mary grew up. Mary enjoyed her flower garden, computer, reading, bridge, and family and friends. Mary survived by her stepdaughter Debbie, her grandchildren Kaylee and Rodney Jr., and great-grandson Rodney III, as well as her brother-in-law Mike Beach, many nieces and nephews around Iowa, and wonderful friends throughout several states. Mary is preceded in death by her special person and husband, Charlie Beach, her present parents, and her siblings, Floyd, Margie, and Paul. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions are suggested to Wesley Life Meals on Wheels and or Spurgeon Manor Nursing Home. Online condolences can be made to the family at CaldwellParish.com. Jeanette Ellen Voss of Wichita, 64, a preschool teacher, dies Saturday, April 13th. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. on Thursday, April 18th at River Lawn Christian Church. Preceded in death by her husband, Thomas Allen Voss, and father, Vincent Merrill Drake, Jr., and she survived by her son, Daniel Voss of Belton, Missouri, Douglas Voss of Mays, Kansas, Dustin Voss of Wichita, mother, Ellen Drake, several grandchildren, and brothers and sisters. Services are in care of Dowling and Leahy Mortuary East Chapel. You can share tributes online at dlwichita.com. Stephen Craig Kiffner, 70, of Pleasant Hill, passed away on Saturday, April 13th. Steve was born March 29th, 1954, in Des Moines, to Arthur and Ruby Scrivener Kiffner. He graduated from East High School in 1972. After graduation, Steve worked for the Parks and Recreation Department. He retired as a supervisor with the City of Des Moines, Glendale, and Woodland Cemeteries. He then went to work at McCall Monument. Steve married the love of his life, Pam, on September 20th, 1975. Steve and Pam were avid golfers and enjoyed traveling the world together, along with friends and family. His family was everything. He was a storyteller and would love to just talk with others. He enjoyed going out, and all the staff loved him. He was a great tipper. Those left to his memory, to cherish his memory, include his five sons, three grandchildren, sister-in-law Dee Dee Hammond, brother-in-law Jeff Kutwick, nieces and nephews Kathy, Jordan, Deb, and Mark, best friend Charles and Patty Crawford, cousins, and other loving family members. He was preceded in death by the love of his life, his wife of 47 years, Pam, and his siblings Sharon and Shirley, and his parents. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. on Monday, April 22nd, at Hamilton's Funeral Home at 605 Lyon Street, with a luncheon to follow. Private family burial will take place at Glen Hill Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be directed to the family. Condolences may be expressed at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. August, known as Augie H. Luthens, age 91, passed peacefully in West Des Moines on April 12th. Augie was born on February 25th, 1933, in Clear Lake, Minnesota, to Ida Ruthney Luthens and August Carl Luthens. He was baptized at the Acoma Lutheran Church and confirmed in the Peace Lutheran Church in Hutchinson, Minnesota. Augie was the only son and youngest among five children. Augie's mother died when he was 2 years old. His sisters, Viola, Elva, Evelyn, and Loretta, known as Patsy, became his surrogate mothers. Augie was active in athletics at Hutchinson High School, where he also served as student body president, eventually graduated in 1951. In the fall of 1951, Augie enrolled at Drake University in Des Moines after receiving a football scholarship. He played on its varsity squad as a tight end and wide receiver. Augie was a member of Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity at Drake and greatly enjoyed the camaraderie and beer it provided, along with the opportunity to meet the love of his life, Suzanne Ulls. Augie graduated from Drake in 1955 with a B.S. in education and married Sue later that year. After graduating from Drake, Augie taught industrial arts at Des Moines Technical High. Augie and Sue soon thereafter began their family, eventually having 5 children, Kurt, Matthew, Sarah, Eric, and Tom. After teaching school, Augie worked as a claims adjuster for various insurance carriers. In his spare time, he refereed high school football and basketball throughout Northwest and Central Iowa for over 15 years. While Augie was working full-time for Continental Western Insurance Company as a claims adjuster, while Sue was home raising their 4 young children, he enrolled in Drake Law School as a part-time student, eventually receiving his Juris Doctorate in 1969. Augie eventually went to work for Preferred Risk Insurance Company in West Des Moines, now known as Guide One Insurance, where he became National Claim Manager, Director of Underwriting and Product Development, as well as in-house counsel during his 15 years there. He also was a part-time instructor at Drake Law School. In 1981, Augie went into private law practice, initially with an office in Colfax. In 1991, son Eric joined him in practice, at which time they formed Luthen's Law Office, P.C., and opened a second office in West Des Moines. Augie and Eric practiced law together for over 28 years. Over the years, Augie participated in Sunday evening radio broadcasts on WHO with his friend Jack Witzel, providing legal advice on various employment-related law matters. In later years, Augie confined his legal practice to tax, real estate, and estate planning, retiring at age 89. Augie is survived by his children. He was preceded in death by his wife Suzanne, sons Matthew in infancy, and Tom, his parents, sisters Viola Stratton, Elva Mishuk, Evelyn Prochow, and Loretta Damier, and wife Kathleen. Augie was a member of Plymouth Congregational Church in Des Moines and an active biblical interpretation student. The family is greatly appreciative of the care Augie received at Cedar Ridge Village Care Facility in West Des Moines over the past few months, and especially his nurse, Ty, who provided him special care and attention. The family requests no flowers. Augie requests that any memorials be given to Plymouth Congregational Church. Also, as per Augie's request, no funeral services are planned. A celebration of life will be announced at a later date. Vivian, known as Viv Irene Albin, 90, passed away on April 14th. A funeral service will be held on April 19th at Wiles Westover Chapel at 6337 Hickman Road. Beginning at 2 p.m., burial will follow at Harper Cemetery in rural Redfield. Vivian Irene Brandstatter was born on November 15, 1933, to Clarence and Jesse Brandstatter in her grandmother's house in Casey, Iowa. She and her twin brother, Warren Brandstatter, attended Redfield High School and Tarkio College in Missouri. Viv married Clarence, known as Vic Albin, in 1957 in Kansas City, Missouri. She worked for Drake University Residential Life as a night receptionist in Jewett Hall for 20 years, as well as Mercy One Urgent Care in Clive as a receptionist. Viv loved to travel, especially anywhere she could drive to, and collecting souvenir mugs. She loved to photograph anything. Viv was a devoted grandmother. Viv and Vic were members of Emmanuel United Methodist Church for 30 years. Viv is survived by her daughter, Carol White, brother, Warren, grandson, Jackson, several nieces and nephews. She is preceded in death by her husband, Vic Albin, son, Clarence Wesley Albin, her parents, sister, Mary McCleary. Please visit islescares.com to leave online condolences. Jose Reyes Cordova passed away on March 23rd at the age of 77. Jose was born in Acapulco, Mexico. As a kid, he spent most of his days playing soccer, going to wrestling matches with his father, and swimming with friends at the beach. He is survived by his wife, Maria, and his 3 children, Lucille, Vianney, known as Mike, Gabe, and his granddaughter, Belen. Jose met the love of his life, Maria, in San Diego in 1986 while at church. It was love at first sight, and they were soon married and started a family. They moved to Iowa in 1994, where he lived and worked until his passing. Jose Lopez spending time on his art, filling his room with countless paintings and sharing them with family and friends. He adored his cat, Sophie. She was a true companion, and they were inseparable in his later years. He loved music, cooking, and spending time with his wife, kids, and granddaughter. He was very passionate about his work and was a wizard with concrete. He never encountered a job that he couldn't conquer. Above all, though, Jose was kind. It becomes obvious after speaking to anyone who befriended him that kindness was his biggest virtue. With his smile and laugh, he helped make this world a happier place every day by just being himself. Jose will be honored in a celebration of life ceremony in coming weeks. And we honor the memory of Diane Marie Lester, who peacefully transitioned to her heavenly home on April 11th in Des Moines at the age of 73. Diane's life was a testament to the boundless power of love and faith. Diane was known for her kind, loving, and caring nature. She was a dedicated wife, an amazing mother and grandmother, and family meant everything to her. She was selfless, always putting others' needs before her own, and was adored by her grandkids. Diane is survived her husband Gerald Lester, children, grandchildren, many, many great-grandchildren, siblings, and many family and friends. Diane's career involved working in the mailroom at Hawkeye Security Insurance and Aviva. She found solace and worship at Faith Independent Assembly. Services by Diane will be held with a viewing on Friday, April 19th, from 4 to 8 p.m. at Hamilton's Funeral Home at 605 Lyon Street. The funeral will take place on Saturday, April 20th at 1 p.m. at Hamilton's, followed by burial services at Laurel Hill Cemetery. A luncheon and reception following the burial will be held at Sundry Lutheran Church at 4100 6th Avenue in Des Moines.
Thank you, Barb. That concludes today's obituaries. Turning now back to national news. Court says Idaho can ban kids' transition care. Justices could hear similar Tennessee and Kentucky cases. The Supreme Court on Monday said Idaho can enforce a state law banning gender transition care for minors, except for two transgender teenagers who are challenging the law. The court did so over the objections of three liberal justices. It's the first time that justices have weighed in on restrictions on puberty blockers and hormone therapy for transgender people younger than 18, an issue that has divided lower federal courts and is part of a wave of conservative legislation and litigation aimed at transgender Americans. The court could also decide soon whether it will review such bans in Tennessee and Kentucky. That decision would come as transgender issues have become an increasingly potent political issue. Passed last year, Idaho's law is being challenged by families of two transgender teenagers. After lower courts temporarily blocked enforcement, Idaho asked the Supreme Court to let it go into effect with an exception carved out for the challengers. The American Civil Liberties Union, which is representing the two Idaho families, said that option won't protect the teenagers as medical providers won't want to take to risk triggering a law that could put them behind bars for a decade. Also, the teens would have to give up their anonymity. Filed as an emergency request, Idaho's appeal to the High Court is a prelude to the larger pending issue, whether the justices will uphold such bans, which have proliferated in recent years. Families of transgender children have asked the Supreme Court to overturn a ruling by the Cincinnati-based U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, allowing Kentucky and Tennessee to ban gender-affirming medical care for minors. The Justice Department has weighed in on the side of the families, telling the court that its input is urgently needed to definitively resolve whether the bans are discriminatory. These laws and the conflicting court decisions about their validity are creating profound uncertainty for transgender adolescents and their families around the nation, Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar said in a filing. The court could announce as early as this month if it will hear the appeals. Combined with other state actions to restrict the bathrooms transgender students can use and what sports teams they can join, the laws are expected to be a major issue in this year's elections. Former President Donald Trump, the presumptive GOP nominee, has said he will press Congress to pass a law banning gender-affirming care for minors and will cut federal funding for schools pushing transgender insanity if he returns to the White House. President Joe Biden has boasted about steps he's taken to strengthen the rights of transgender and all LGBTQ1+ Americans. Since 2022, the number of states taking steps to limit access to gender-affirming care for minors has grown from 4 to 23, according to the nonpartisan health research organization KFF. Restrictions were fully in effect in 17 states as of January. That's despite the fact that most major medical groups support youth access to gender-affirming care. The American Medical Association has called the state bans a, quote, dangerous intrusion of government into the practice of medicine and the criminalization of healthcare decision-making, end quote. Gender-affirming care is medically necessary and evidence-based care that improves the physical and mental health of transgender and gender-diverse people. Dr. Michael Suk, a member of the AMA board, said when the group reinforced its opposition to state bans in 2021. One of the transgender teenage girls challenging Idaho's law suffered from depression, anxiety, and self-harm before starting gender-affirming medical care, according to filings. The mental health of other teens likewise deteriorated as puberty began. Their parents have told the courts they're terrified about the impact on their daughter's health and lives if they can't continue treatment. Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador argued the law is needed to protect vulnerable children from what he called, quote, risky and dangerous medical procedures. Idaho should be able to protect children from experimental medical procedures that cause irreversible and lifelong harms, Labrador wrote in his appeal to the Supreme Court. Originally scheduled to go into effect in January, Idaho's law was temporarily blocked by a district court judge in Idaho while it's being litigated. The San Francisco-based U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit upheld that decision in January. Despite the litigation swirling around transgender minors, the Supreme Court has largely been silent on the issue. In April, the High Court sided with a 12-year-old transgender girl who was challenging a West Virginia ban on transgender athletes joining girls' sports teams, temporarily blocking the state from enforcing the prohibition. The ruling came on the court's emergency docket and did not resolve the underlying questions in the case. In January, the Supreme Court declined to decide whether schools can bar transgender students from using a bathroom that reflects their gender identity, leaving in place a lower court ruling that allowed a transgender middle school boy in Indiana to use the boy's bathroom.
Zelensky signs an army draft law to reinforce tired troops. Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky has signed into law a bill overhauling army mobilization rules, according to the parliamentary website, as Ukraine seeks to address acute troop shortages in its fight against Russia. More than 2 years into the war, Ukraine is on the back foot, and its top military commander on the eastern front line has said Russian forces outnumbered its own by up to 10 times. Kyiv needs fresh troops to strengthen its positions and rotate its exhausted military. The law will come into force a month after it is officially published. It obliges men to update their draft data with the authorities, boost payments to those who volunteer, and adds new punishments for draft dodging. It remains unclear how many troops could be mobilized under the new provisions, although some serving military personnel and analysts have expressed concern that the law would not be effective enough in addressing the shortages. The bill signed into law on Tuesday also lacks the much tougher sanctions for draft evasion that were contained in the initial version. The draft sparked public outcry, and there were more than 4,000 amendments before the final reading in Parliament. Ukraine began mobilization immediately after Russia's invasion in February of 2022. The country initially saw a significant influx of volunteer fighters, but numbers later plunged, with thousands of cases of draft evasion reported since. Kyiv troops are facing a shortage of ammunition supplies, with vital funding from the U.S. blocked by Republicans in Congress for months, and the EU failing to deliver munitions on time, while Russian forces are inching forward. Army Chief Oleksandr Sivsky said last week the situation on the Eastern Front had significantly escalated recently, and that Russian troops aimed to capture the town of Chasiv Yar by May 9th. Ukrainian officials also warned Moscow might be preparing for another offensive later this spring or in summer. A lack of air defense missiles prevented Ukraine from thwarting a Russian missile attack last week that destroyed the biggest power plant in the region around the capital, Kyiv, Zelensky said. Zelensky's comments, which followed repeated warnings from his government to its allies about scarce air defenses, reflect the dire situation in Ukraine finds itself in as Russia scales up strikes on its energy system. Reuters was not able to independently verify the account. Zelensky had earlier warned that Ukraine has already had to make tough choices about what to protect and said his country could run out of defensive missiles entirely if Russia attacks continued apace. Russia has stepped up combined missile and drone strikes targeting Ukraine's grid system since mid-March. In recent attacks, Ukraine lost about 7 gigawatts of power generating capacity, with major thermal power plants and transmitting capabilities significantly damaged. Moscow said the strikes are aimed at degrading Ukraine's ability to fight and are in retaliation for recent attacks inside Russia.
Other international news, police say Australia church attack a terrorist incident. A stabbing attack at a church in Sydney that left 4 people injured has been declared an act of terrorism, Australian police said Tuesday morning. It was the second mass attack in the city in less than 72 hours. We believe there are elements that are satisfied in terms of religious-motivated extremism, New South Wales State Police Commissioner Karen Webb said during a news conference. The attack took place Monday evening at the Assyrian Christ the Good Shepherd Church in the city suburb of Wakeley, according to police. At least 4 people were wounded in the attack, including a parish priest and a popular but controversial bishop. A teenager was arrested at the scene, Webb said, but his identity has not yet been released. Bishop Mari Emanuel was stabbed when the teenager lunged at him with a knife, police said. A video of the attack shows the bishop delivering a sermon from behind a pulpit when the teen, wearing a black sweatshirt, approaches. Emmanuel's live stream sermons attract a global audience, and his video clips rack up hundreds of thousands of views online. A sermon uploaded on YouTube last year showed the bishop criticizing Islam. The knife attack triggered clashes outside the church between police and an angry crowd of the bishop's followers who demanded the attacker be handed over to them. Emergency crews said they attended to about 30 people after the clash outside the church, and 7 were taken to the hospitals. Several police were also hospitalized, and 20 police vehicles were damaged, Webb said. Police attended the incident in Wakeley last night to assist that community, and the crowd turned on the police, Webb said. Those involved in the riot can expect a knock at the door, she added. Webb said the agency will increase police presence across the city, adding that a counter-terror team was being formed to investigate the crime. Mass attacks are rare in Australia, a country that has strict gun laws. Well, it's time for us to take a break here, and for the past 90 minutes, your readers have been Barb DeHack and Dennis May. It has been our pleasure to read for you. So now we're going to take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Pam Rhodes and Patty Daniels. We'll continue with the articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Pamela with our first article.
President wants even more of my tax dollars. My husband and I both work full-time. We like our jobs, but we work hard. Our reward? Sending thousands of dollars to federal government each year. Much like millions of other Americans on tax day, we had to write a large check and send it off to the Internal Revenue Service. It's always painful to kiss that money goodbye. It's even more difficult when I know just how poorly it will be spent. Case in point, President Joe Biden continues to doggedly pursue student loan forgiveness ahead of the November election. Perhaps Biden misread his job description. Instead of commander-in-chief, he is acting like the panderer-in-chief. Excuse me. Essentially, he's using our tax dollars as campaign funds. It seems not a week goes by when Biden isn't announcing some plan that will magically wipe out swaths of student loans. That's intentional, as Biden struggles with keeping young voters interested in his candidacy. The president's betting that erasing all this debt will buy him more votes come November. That became more urgent after the U.S. Supreme Court last summer overturned his initial unilateral attempt to cancel more than $4 billion in debt. Rather than learn anything from this setback, Biden immediately set off to find other ways he could force taxpayers to cover the cost of paying off other people's student loans, never mind that the president's new efforts are almost surely just as unconstitutional as his first try. As a taxpayer and someone who has paid off my college loans, I find Biden's costly new entitlement program to be irksome. After all, the debt doesn't simply go away. It is loaded onto taxpayers' backs and is added to our $34 trillion and counting national debt. Last week, Biden waved his magic wand again, announcing his latest round of lucky borrowers, more than 270,000 people in Biden's revamped income-driven repayment plans will see $7.4 billion in debt canceled. That brings Biden's total debt transference from student loan borrowers to taxpayers at large to $153 billion. About 4.3 million borrowers have benefited from Biden's generosity with taxpayers' money, and Biden has plans to expand who's eligible in coming months through a different program. In addition to adding to the national debt and our tax burden as a country, Biden's actions are inflammatory. Out-of-control government spending is one reason why inflation has remained so entrenched during his administration. My guess is most people who get their student loan debt zeroed out by Biden will go on some sort of spending spree. Progressive superstar Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez recently admitted as much while on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. The U.S. representative from New York said Biden's latest student cancellation proposal means hope to buy a house or to have a kid or travel abroad or maybe even go back to school. That tracks with what a 2022 poll found after Biden's initial debt plan rolled out. According to Intelligent.com, 73% of anticipated recipients said they plan to spend the forgiven amount on non-essential things like travel, eating out, and new gadgets. These are things that most Americans want. But why should taxpayers who didn't go to college or who have paid off their debt subsidize the spending decisions of strangers? And let's not forget the most egregious part of Biden's tax dollar giveaway. He loves to tout how this election is all about democracy. In continuing with such sweeping executive action, however, the president's proving that he is a threat to our system of checks and balances. Biden has failed to go through Congress, which should sign off on such a costly expenditure, and he has ignored a pointed rebuke from the Supreme Court. the Biden administration is once again looking to have a huge unilateral and hence unconstitutional student debt cancellation, Neil McCluskey, education policy expert at the Cato Institute, Institute observed on X, "I don't appreciate my hard-earned dollars being used by Biden to buy favor among voters, and I resent that he's doing it in such a blatantly undemocratic manner. This article is written by Ingrid Jax, who is a columnist at the USA Today. You can contact her at ijax@usatoday.com or on X, formerly Twitter, at Ingrid_Jock.
Thank you, Pam. Well, here's another article on the editorial on the same subject, but it's on the other side, written for us by Sarah Pequefla. Stop hating on Biden for student debt relief plan. Last week, President Joe Biden's administration unveiled yet another student debt relief plan. It was the latest announcement from a presidency that will be remembered for student loan debt forgiveness, regardless of your place on the political spectrum. By this fall, more than 30 million people might benefit from the new proposals, which are supposed to fulfill one of Biden's 2020 campaign promises just in time for the general election. This is in addition to the estimated 4 million people who have already had their loans forgiven through past executive actions from Biden. The new program will be as close as the president can get to his initial plan with the conservative hurdles he has had to clear, including the Supreme Court ruling against him. It addresses multiple types of borrowers, those who have had loans for more than 20 years, borrowers who have interest on their loans and make less than $120,000 a year, plus borrowers experiencing financial hardship. It's good, great even, that Biden is forgiving this debt. Today's college graduates are saddled with more debt immediately out of college than our predecessors. Gone are the days of paying off your loans with summer jobs or those first few post-grad paychecks. It shows that his administration is aware how different the system is compared with decades prior. About 43 million people have federal student loan debt, equating to more than $1.6 trillion. Include private loans, and it's an additional $131 billion. This is something that affects people's lives day in and day out, and it has become increasingly common with each new generation. Pew Research Center found that those born after 1996 are on track to be the most well-educated generation. A Gallup poll last year found that 83% of Generation Z thinks college is very important or fairly important. Biden knows this, and it could pay off for him in November. Right now, the president is being criticized heavily by Gen Z for his stance on Gaza, and he needs to appeal to younger voters who may be wary of heading to the polls. Student loan debt relief is a surefire way to win over progressive voters, even if part of the program is aimed at people 20 years their senior. The plan also should win Biden points with Generation X and millennials who owe more debt on average. Criticism of this plan, the idea that Biden is buying votes, fails to address the new cost of college and the potential for improving the economy. It's understandable that older generations feel frustrated by the debt relief Biden is providing. It's also true that student loan debt has doubled over the past two decades because of the increase in students pursuing degrees after high school. There is also a racial disparity in student loan debt. Black and Latino voters are more likely to have to take on debt and have higher levels of debt on average. Canceling student loan debt helps mitigate the factors that keep people economically behind their peers. Borrowers still are feeling the effects of the pandemic as well. About 40% of federal student loan borrowers missed their first payment post-COVID repayment freeze. When older generations complain about younger people being entitled, they should remember that debt relief helps the economy overall because it helps people save money for milestone purchases like buying a car or a house. By following up on a campaign promise that would benefit millions, Biden is reminding voters of why they voted for him in the first place. Many people were unenthused about voting for him in 2020. He had neither the grassroots support of Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont nor the newcomer's advantage of Pete Buttigieg. The progressive agenda that Biden's White House touted was a sign that he knew younger voters weren't going to accept vote blue no matter who, and he exemplified that on day one by extending the pause on repaying student loans. Even though the first attempt to forgive millions of borrowers eventually was overruled, the administration has continued to push forward and forgive loans for borrowers who meet specific criteria. Biden already had forgiven $138 billion of student loan debt before last week's news. The new initiative is a sign that Biden understands what will get people to the polls. If his team is smart, they'll keep Biden's student loan relief as a tenet of his 2024 campaign. And you can follow USA Today elections columnist Sarah Pequeño on X, formerly Twitter, at Sarah horizontal line Pequeño, and Facebook, facebook.com/Pequeño. Rights.
We're going to turn now to sports, and this is the sports that is going to be on television today. All of the times are the Eastern time zone. Wednesday, April 17, hockey, National Hockey League, 7 p.m., TNT/TRU TV/Max, Toronto at Tampa Bay. 9:30, TNT/TRUT/Max, St. Louis at Dallas. Basketball, National Basketball Association, 7 p.m., ESPN, Miami at Philadelphia. 9:30 p.m., ESPN, Atlanta at Chicago. Baseball, Major League Baseball, 12:10 p.m., MLBN, San Francisco at Miami, 1:10 p.m. MLBN, San Diego at Milwaukee, 2:10 p.m. ESPN Plus, Atlanta at Houston, 3:07 p.m. MLBN, New York Yankees at Toronto, 4:10 p.m. MLBN, Cincinnati at Seattle, 6:50 p.m., MLBN, LA Angels at Tampa Bay, and 7:10 p.m., MLBN, Cleveland and Boston. And here is just a little something to add to that. In brief, Paris 2024 Olympic torch lit. Ancient Olympia, Greece. The torch for the Paris 2024 Olympic Games was lit in ancient Olympia, in a traditional ceremony on Tuesday, marking the final stretch of the seven-year preparations for the Games start on July 26. Greek actress Mary Mina, playing the role of high priestess, lit the torch using a backup flame instead of a parabolic mirror due to the cloudy skies for the start of the relay in Greece and France. It will culminate with the lighting of the Olympic flame at the opening ceremony.
Clark's historic career turns page to the next challenge, written for us by Tyler Talkman, and he's part of the Register and the USA Today Network. Caitlin Clark is hugging Lisa Bluder. They are holding each other close. This is the raw passion of a coach-player bond that has grown over the last several years. And part of what has made this moment so special is they envisioned this long ago. Go back to before all the records Clark set at Iowa, before she became a transcendent figure in the basketball world, skyrocketing so high that she is featured in commercials and discussed by LeBron James. Go back to when Clark was at recruit, okay, at Dowling Catholic High School in West Des Moines, and Bluder, the longtime Hawkeye coach, came over for a home visit. I think the biggest thing is that we talked about this moment, Clark said Monday. We dreamed of this, but she also believed I would be here, and she reached me really hard. Coached me really hard to get to this moment. And now Clark is living it. They are living it, hugging each other at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in Brooklyn, New York on Monday. Clark was just selected first overall by the Indiana Fever in the 2024 WNBA draft. After an historic college career, Clark etched her name in the Hawkeye lore again Monday, becoming the first player in program history to go first overall in the WNBA draft. There was a lot of ups and downs, and something I really appreciate about Coach Bluder is like no matter what awards or success or wins we ever had or I had, she never stopped coaching me, Clark said. She never stopped holding me accountable. She always thought there were ways to help me get better. She still thinks that. And I think that. That's one of the things that I just love about her. The lead up to the 2024 WNBA draft unfolded in emphatically Caitlin Clark fashion, meaning that she lived like a modern day sports rock star. The last several days have included, but not been limited to, playing in the national championship game against South Carolina on Sunday, April 7th. Attending the end-of-season celebration at Carver Hawkeye Arena on Tuesday, April 9. During that gathering, University of Iowa Athletics Director Beth Goetz announced that Clark's number 22 will be retired. Attending the Wooden Awards ceremony on Friday, April 12, in Los Angeles, which included seeing actor Jason Sudeikis and posing with her own AFC Richmond jersey from the show Ted Lasso. Appearing on Saturday Night Live the following day, where she exposed Michael Che about as badly as she does to defenders on the court. Being selected as the number one overall pick in the 2024 WNBA draft on Monday. Obviously, the course of the last few weeks has been pretty insane in my life, Clark admitted Monday. Squeezed in between returning from the NCAA title game and the end-of-season ceremony at Carver, she even made a trip home. I drove directly home, had my mom cook me a meal, and then I drove back to Iowa City the next day, Clark said. Speaking in the context of taking the next step in her basketball career, Clark delivered a sobering reminder on Monday. I'm 22 years old, Clark says. I don't have all the answers in the world. This is something new to me. This is a challenge, and it's something I'm excited for. That detail, being 22, might be somewhat overlooked. Clark does unequivocally impressive things on the court. The dazzling assists, the deep bombs from three-point range. She holds the record for most points scored by a Division I basketball player, men's or women's. Her greatness took Iowa women's basketball to new heights. The Hawkeyes went back-to-back Final Fours, 2023 and 2024, as excitement surrounding the program exploded. But it became bigger than just becoming a local star. She became the face of the growing game of women's basketball. That has come with attention and scrutiny. It also brought responsibilities, many of them including in the business world. Even as she takes the next step in her career, it's not unfair to wonder, can someone so young continue to handle all of this? But if the past is an indication, she can, because she already did. The past season for Iowa was an absolute media circus. Clark was seared in the spotlight, and yet she still produced, averaging the most points per game of her career and carrying the team to another Final Four appearance. Sponsorships stay the same, Clark said. The people around me, agents and whatnot, have been able to help me and guide me through the course of this last year. I don't know if I would be in this moment if it wasn't for a lot of them. My mom has done a lot. My dad has done a lot. In college, I always said my main focus is on basketball. That's why I've had every other opportunity to my life because of the way I carry myself, the way I play the game. Going into my professional career, I plan to do the exact same thing. My focus is solely on basketball, being the best I can. It's not surprising, then, that Clark has approached the event, the recent whirlwind, with maturity. I think the biggest thing is I'm just very lucky to be in this moment, and all of these opportunities and these things, they're once in a lifetime, Clark said. And when things might get tiring or you have to do stuff, I think the biggest thing is to look at it as an opportunity. This isn't something everybody gets to do. It's once in a lifetime and just trying to soak in every single experience. Clark is turning back the clock again. This time, she is recalling a story from during her freshman season at Iowa, a time when the world was in a drastically different state due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Iowa was playing Kentucky in the round of 32 in the 2021 NCAA tournament. Tamika Catchings was on the television broadcast for that game. I was like tweaking out, Clark remembers. I couldn't believe she was calling one of my games. Somebody that I idolize, somebody that I love, and somebody that is not only a great basketball player and everything that she did, but she's a tremendous person. This holds significance now. Catchings is a legendary pillar for the Indiana Fever organization. She was a 10-time All-Star, including being the league's MVP in 2011. Catchings helped deliver the Fever's only title in 2022. But following Catchings' retirement in 2016, things haven't been the same for the Fever. Since then, Indiana has missed playoffs for the last 7 seasons. Only twice during that stretch has Indiana accumulated double-digit wins in a season. Clark can help try to change that. The way she puts it, trying to get the franchise back to championship habits. She will now join another young, rising star, Aliyah Boston, who was the number one overall pick in the 2023 WNBA draft. Boston was last season's Rookie of the Year. In my eyes, one of the best players in the league, Clark said of Boston. And like I said, as a point guard, my biggest job is I'm just feeding Aliyah the ball every single game. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go in there and be like, hey, go make a layup. She's going to make my life easy. She's incredible. But the one thing I love about her is like she's just a great person.
Turning now to Dear Abby, romance between relatives upsets pairs close friends. Dear Abby, my husband's best friend Kevin lost his wife 3 years ago. He's in a relationship with his niece, his deceased brother's daughter. Kevin is in his 60s, she's in her 50s. We find this disgusting and do not condone it. They are both from Portugal. Is this acceptable in other countries? We have tried to discuss it with him. He says he doesn't care what we think. Kevin tries to plan things for all of us as couples, and we don't want to be in their company. Am I wrong? I have known his niece for several years, and I don't want to be unkind, but I just cannot be around them. His wonderful wife is turning over in her grave. Signed, Scandalized in New Jersey. Dear Scandalized, this type of incestuous relationship is not specifically prohibited under Portuguese law, nor is it prohibited in the state of New Jersey. If you don't wish to socialize with this couple, you are not compelled to do it. Your husband can do it without you if he wishes. Dear Abby, A childhood friend generously invited me to stay at his home for a visit. We had a great time. A few days after I left, he texted me that something expensive was missing from his home and asked if I knew anything about it. I told him I was sorry to hear the bad news and I don't know what happened. He has now blocked me on all forms of communication. I suppose he thinks I had something to do with a missing item. I wonder if I could have handled the situation differently. Should I have perhaps offered to compensate him for at least part of the value of the missing item, despite not being responsible for its disappearance? I don't want to appear to admit fault, but I'm sad that our friendship has apparently ended over this. Signed, Innocent in Florida. Dear Innocent, if you offer to compensate your host, it will look like an admission of guilt. Don't do it. If you feel you must say anything at this point, write the person a letter expressing not only are you sorry is missing the item in question, but also that its disappearance has ended what was, to you, a treasured friendship. Period. Dear Abby, my husband is a gun owner. I am not. My mother sometimes stays over and sleeps in his office, which doubles as a guest room. My husband tells me before my mother goes into the room to sleep that I should make sure the gun is safely put away in the case she snoops around and finds it and an accident happens. I told him that it is his responsibility as a gun owner, not mine. I also told him my mother won't snoop in his workstation. He continues to tell me to check it just in case. And I repeat that it's my responsibility. Who's responsible to check if the gun is properly put away, my husband or me? Signed, Not My Task in the East. Dear MNMT, you are both responsible to ensure the safety of your guests. Your husband's gun should be safely locked in a gun case to prevent anyone from shooting themselves in the foot. Because your husband shirks his responsibility in order to protect your mother, you should do it. If you wish to contact Dear Abby, you can get her at www.dearabby.com.
That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Patty Daniels, and my partner at the microphone has been Pam Rhodes. Earlier, you heard Barb DeHeck and Dennis May. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.